Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. My name is Geert, and I'm your host for today on NBN's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast once again. Teun, I'm glad you found the time to talk to us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for your interest in my work, I would say.
So I'll briefly introduce you to our listeners. Dr. Teun Voete, he is educated as an anthropologist and a philosopher, and he has been a photographer of wars and conflicts for at least 3 decades, if I'm correct. As such, he has covered many different areas worldwide, ranging from Sierra Leone through New York to Sudan and beyond. And in 2018, an adaptation of his PhD thesis was published in the Netherlands on the logic behind drug-related violence in Mexico. This has now been translated into English and published with Small Wars Journal as Mexican Drug Violence, Hybrid Warfare, Predatory Capitalism, and the Logic of Cruelty. And this is what we'll be discussing. So to start off, what made you decide to specifically put so much an research effort into studying Mexico, and why now?
Yeah, everything is coincidental in my life. As you told, I've been photographing war since 1991. I had already a vague interest in drugs and crime and war. I was in 1990. I was already a student in Colombia. I photographed the gang violence in Honduras in 2008. I did a story about homeless drug addicts, basically homeless people living in the tunnel, and everybody was doing crack at that time in 95. I wrote a book about it. So I had basically an interest in war and the angle with drugs, because in every war there is a drug angle. Either wars are financed by drugs or fought over drugs, or nearly always fought under the influence of drugs. For some reason, in 2009, I read somewhere a news clip that Ciudad Juarez was the most dangerous city on the world. And I read about it, and I was really intrigued by it. So I went there, and I made a photo story for about 10 days, 2 weeks. But I was completely shocked by the level of violence, by the impunity, by the cruelty. And the weird thing was, I'm used to these levels of violence in so-called new wars like Sierra Leone, Liberia, Afghanistan, post-Soviets. But Mexico was a completely sophisticated modern state. You cannot call it a failed state. So the violence was so intriguing. I went back. After Ciudad Juarez, I went back another time. I traveled to Culiacán, to Sinaloa, and then basically I made 12 trips, and that became a photo book. And I was very proud of that photo book. But as a photographer, photography is a great way of communication, but you miss something. You cannot address the social, political, anthropological context. So during my photo trips, I met some students and some PhDs, some doctors, and so I decided, you know what, I'm going to write a PhD as well on it. And so it was basically pretty easy. I went to my old university, to an old professor, and he supervised me to write the PhD thesis. I didn't have to go back to school. And basically, when I was writing my PhD thesis, it's about Mexico, but I compared the Mexican situation with all the other wars I've been in, and basically it's built around three angles. The one angle is the dynamic of the warfare in Mexico, because I really think you can call it a war. I mean, some people don't call it a war, but if you look at the amount of casualties and the tactics used and the enormous big caliber weapons and helicopters and RPGs and armed vehicles, it is a war. But a special kind of war. So I described the dynamics of the war, and then I looked at the economic angle. That chapter is called Predatory Capitalism, and I looked first briefly in how far the economic inequality is responsible for the drug violence, and yes, it's a favorable circumstance for drug crime to flourish if you have poverty and economic inequality. But what I found more interesting is how you can describe the DTOs, the drug trafficking organizations, as hyper-predatory capitalist corporations who profit is the only aim, but who use nearly all other who function nearly the same as legal corporations. The only difference is that they use violence and that they operate outside of the law, but there are incredible similarities. And the last chapter, the cruelty of violence, I mean the logic of cruelty, is basically how people can become killers. It's more at anthropological level, how individual can start to kill other people, not only that, but actually start to enjoy it and actually commit gross acts of extreme violence, which most people would call inhumane. But I my thesis is it's not inhumane, it's human behavior as well. And there again, I talked to 6 or 7 or 8 sicarios, assassins for hire, in the jail in Ciudad Juarez, in prison. But I also made comparison with the experiences I have in other wars with jihadis. I wrote also a book about child soldiers in Sierra Leone who nearly killed me, but it's another story. So I made basically a cross-cultural comparison between Mexican assassins for hire with West African child soldiers and jihadis. And I looked also a little bit in the literature of Vietnam veterans and First and Second World War veterans. So that's basically how the thesis was set up. And while I was writing my thesis, I actually noticed that the 30 years of war photography was a great preparation. It's actually, being a war photographer is actually a brilliant way for anthropology to explore conflict, because you really have to be at the front line. I mean, I was embedded with Americans. You hang out 2 weeks with a platoon of 20 Americans and you hang out with rebels. And as a social scientist, they normally don't do that.
No, and I think you did a great job there as well, because even the initial chapters are theory heavy, but you gather all these small case studies or small stories from your experience to enrich them. I think that's one of the big qualities of the book. I mean, there's more.
Yeah, I mean, I like theory, but I think theory should be illustrated by examples from in the field.
Yeah, I'd like to start somewhere specific regarding the content. So you describe an event in Nuevo Laredo in the early 2000s, and there you say this is the moment when the war on drugs transformed into the drug war. What happened here, and why is this transformation important? Would you say?
Well, basically, the Mexican drug war or Mexican drug violence, however you want to call it, you have actually different wars fought at the same time, and that's why I also call it hybrid warfare, because it's has different front line, different intensities, different players who merge from one group to another and transform themselves. So it's a very fluid warfare. And actually, I have one chapter in which I describe you have not one drug war, you have actually 7 drug wars at least. You have the wars from authorities against cartels, from one cartel to another cartel. You have sometimes internal power struggle. You have civil society that fights the criminal groups, and they can fight it in a peaceful way with protest, but they can also form self-defense militias that kill criminals. You have civilians that form militias to kill small-time criminals, and the crime of wave from small-time criminals and who flourish in an atmosphere of impunity against civilians. You could call that another war, and then you have government-authorized death squads, and then you have the last, the most crazy, you have like sometimes a proxy war between different authorities. For instance, in Nuevo Laredo, the municipal police was in the pockets of the Zeta cartel, and the government sent the federal police. So at sometimes you had fights between the federal police and the municipal police. And that's what I mentioned in my book. I based myself on the analysis of journalist Ian Grillo, who was at that time at Nuevo Laredo, who made a perfect analysis. And then basically the Sinaloa cartel wanted to invade territory from the Zetas, Nuevo Laredo. And there was the federal police, and they hooked up a little bit with the Sinaloa cartel. And then of course you had the local Zeta cartel with the municipal police. And then the it was a whole level of new violence and with murders, with assassinations, with confrontations between police forces. So this is when you can really say the drug war really started to in all intensity.
So I guess the main point is that somewhere in the early 2000s, complexity became extreme. So the initial framework might have been like, okay, so government principally is fighting or is trying to fight the presence of drugs and the trade in drugs. And then at some point in the early 2000s, of course, it's a process. It's not something that happens at one point, but in the early 2000s, how would you say that it expands into all these different kinds of wars that you describe?
To use a non-academic word, it became a huge clusterfuck, and which remains up to this day. And one thing I should correct you, it has never been a war against authorities, against cartels, because it's not simple, black and white. And of course, the government loves that narrative. But there have been so many examples of gross corruption, and I don't talk about small-time village cops, but even drug czars and General Rebeu was one of the very famous guy. He was head of anti-drug operations, military general, and he was in cahoots with the leader of the Juarez cartel. And actually just last year, another general was arrested, Chen Fuego. So there is what someone wrote. It's not we against them, but some of us against who know who, them and some of us as well. So it's extremely complicated.
Yeah, I figure.
It's not like a classic warfare, and I compare a classic warfare. We have, for instance, Napoleon, the British and the French have different uniforms. They, you know exactly who is who, and they fight on the battlefield. And there is a declaration of war and a ceasefire. But this hybrid warfare is ongoing.
Yeah, I figure.
It's very remarkable because I'm not from Mexico, and as a European, I base myself on a lot of literature, theory of warfare, basically from European scholars, and that kind of literature hardly exists in Latin America. And I mean, Europe, of course, has enormous experience with all kinds of warfare. I mean, through the Second World War, the 30-year old war, the freedom war they fought against the former colonies. Whereas Latin America, and I don't want to play down all the horrible wars, but they only had the war against Spanish independence war. And then there were a few guerrilla movements, but there was never a war between Latin America states. I mean, some skirmishes, but I mean, there is a lot of theory about different forms of warfare in Europe, which you don't have in Latin American literature.
No, of course. And this is something that you quite accurately describe. I mean, you indicate that the different theoretical frameworks that we have to, say, capture the post-World War II conflicts are not really sufficient to capture the situation in Mexico. And even frameworks like greed versus grievances doesn't capture the mechanics, nor does the new war concept. You use this concept of hybrid war. How does this better capture the complexity in Mexico? What does it enlighten?
Well, a hybrid warfare, it's actually... So you have a distinction between classic... First, you have the classic war between states and regular armies. Then you have an tax by authorities, financed by taxation, and then you have the so-called new wars. This is a theoretical framework from Mary Kelder and Herbert Münkler. Very useful to describe situations in Sierra Leone, Liberia, post-Soviet Afghanistan, Angola, all the conflicts where I was myself as a photographer of Colombia. And what you have there is you have a merger between crime and war, and basically war becomes a means in itself. Situation of war is maintained because it creates a very favorable environment for exploitation of natural resources, which are exploited by criminal warlords. And then hybrid warfare is even one step further. And what you certainly also have, you have like a digital cyber dimension coming into place. I mean, what you see with hybrid warfare, I mean, important component is psychological warfare. And of course, psychological warfare has always been a part of war. But with social media, it becomes extremely powerful. And I devote a chapter to, a subchapter to narco propaganda, where cartel groups make gruesome videos and post them on the web. And I make actually comparison with ISIS. I mean, the war of ISIS against the West is also a typical form of hybrid warfare. It has different identities, different front lines. There is no clear demarcation between a combatant and a civilian. And everybody can be a target, and everybody can become a combatant as well. And sometimes this war is simmering underground, and sometimes it explodes right in your face. And that's the characteristic of hybrid warfare. It's actually it was theoretically a little bit challenging comparing ISIS with Mexican drug war, but I did, and the only difference is that ISIS has like ideological religious components, which is absent in the Mexican drug war, but the methods, the dynamics, the propaganda, the extreme violence as a language, as communication, are fairly equal.
And why are we talking exactly? Because you also cite a lot of the economic grounds for the conflict. Why would you say we are specifically talking about drug violence in Mexico and not, for instance, poverty violence or neoliberal violence? What is it in the nature of drugs that makes the situation in Mexico so incredibly explosive?
Neoliberal politics created, of course, a situation where you had huge economic inequality, which was a feeding ground. I mean, a fertile ground for cartels to flourish, to recruit people. But it's not the only explanation. And I think it's more important the special thing about drugs is the profits are enormous, and it's a very diverse business. All people with all kind of experience and level of education can find a job. I mean, you need very sophisticated accountants and lawyers, but you need like the foot soldiers as well, and they don't necessarily need an education. So it's an enormous industry, which can provide a lot of income generation opportunities for people from all walks of life, which you don't have in any other business.
Yeah, no, understandable.
You have the telecom business, and yes, they employ sophisticated people and uneducated people, but I mean the diversity and the dynamic and the income, the money making opportunities are nothing compared with the drug industry.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess that also relates to the high degree of corruption. I mean, if there's so large profits to be gained.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to remain honest. I mean, the amount of money offered to bribe, and this is basically a right offered for these corporations. These are basically business expenses that basically a cartel makes maybe, I would say, 10 million in a month in a certain area. And they set apart 2 million for bribery. It's their way of paying taxes. It's business write-off, and then they have set that money apart.
And okay, no, I fully agree. But why would you say then that Mexico is not necessarily a failed state? Why is it still a stable sort of country?
Well, I mean, I have a whole subchapter of the whole failed state discussion, and to put it very arrogant, you only know what a failed state is if you have once been in it. And I've been in a failed state like Liberia and Sierra Leone. I mean, Liberia, Sierra Leone are these days doing pretty okay, but and I was in Afghanistan in Kabul post-Soviet. It was nothing was functioning, nothing. No infrastructure, no hospitals. No means of communication, no electricity. There was nothing. No culture. I mean, but Mexico has of course, a great communication industry, a great cultural industry, museum, great infrastructure, great hospitals, great universities. So that is all functioning. But only a state should provide for these goods, but also for security. And security is the problem in Mexico, and only in certain parts of Mexico. So it, not the whole of Mexico is completely dangerous and not under the rule of criminals. But you could certainly say that there are certain areas in Mexico that you can consider failed statelets, small states, or you could talk about security failure, but I would never call Mexico a failed state.
No, I understand it, and I think it makes sense what you say.
I mean, my latest trip, I was in Michoacán, and I went deep down in the hinterlands, and there are no authorities, and there you have lots of regions controlled by different armed factions and self-defense militias and auto-defensas and cartel groups. And you have new cartel group invading and there is no rule of law there.
No, I understand. I guess, so in certain areas, government and society is functioning rather well. So there is also a lot of financial means available, and I was wondering. So there's this militarization from the drug related violence from the government side. Would you say that the army is escalating the levels and the scale of cruelty, or is that principally the non-state groups or how does this dynamic work, this escalation of violence?
I mean, people from more leftist background, they like to point the accusing finger at the army. And yes, the army has been found guilty of disappearances and human rights violations, but do not underestimate the militarized, how the cartels have become militarized. I mean, if you look these days at the Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, the most aggressive and expensive cartels, and I mean, the Zetas were originally special forces from the army. And they started the whole militarization of organized crime. And with RPGs and armed vehicles and .50 caliber guns and rifles. And what you see right now, the Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, they sometimes drive around in convoys of 20 SUVs painted in camouflage colors with the logos painted on it. And all the guys are impeccably dressed in desert camouflage uniform how do you call it? Bivac?
Good question. Like face covering masks.
Yeah, the mask, yeah. And with AR-15s, and they somehow imitated this from ISIS, because ISIS also drove in these huge columns with armored vehicles and in camouflage colors and uniforms. So, I mean, the cartels have been completely militarized as well, and then you have like an escalation. I mean, the cartels shot down an army helicopter with an RPG, and sometimes they ambush army and police convoys and kill 20 police at the same time.
I think that the three different themes of your book, they are really all three of them are very important. But in the end, the most pressing question of the book is the why of the cruelty and the violence in Mexico, and I was wondering, because there are many different places in the world where there's the possibility, even through drug trade, or especially through drug trade, to make enormous amounts of money. Why is it escalating in this way, the cruelty in Mexico? What do you think?
I mean, if you look at Holland, there is a lot of, I call Holland the Marco State Light, there is a lot of money is being made in drugs in Holland, but there is violence. There was also one beheading, and a lawyer and a journalist were killed. But it's not at the level as Mexico, and It has to do with a long tradition of violence and escalation and circles of revenge and tactics, and it has to do with the geography of the country. Yeah, you have huge remote regions where cartels can just basically make safe havens for themselves and havens and do whatever they want. And basically, it's a learning curve. There is so much competition between armed groups that in a social Darwinistic mechanism, the most cruel, the most violent group will survive. And I describe that violence not as an aberration, but I describe it as a business strategy. I mean, using extreme violence is sending out a signal. It's a message. It's purely communication. We are the meanest, we are the cruelest, so you better join us or you will be victim. So it has like a recruiting function as well, and it also has a function of intimidating civilians but also authorities into submission. So it's part of a dynamic, and once this cycle of extreme violence has started, it starts basically just tit for tat. And then it escalates.
I fully understand. I think you have a point there. But let me turn the question around then, because the final chapter of your book is... Sorry?
Some people say, a Mexican has a very violent culture. Look at the revolutions and look at the Aztecs. But I looked at that, and actually if you look at the amount of people killed in Europe in the First and Second World War, in Mexico, hundreds of thousands of people are killed in the revolution, but not at the scale we had. So Europe has a much more violent history. And yeah, the Aztecs were violent. They had pretty bloody rituals, but nearly every culture. So that's not a good explanation.
No, I figure. But let me turn the question around then, because your final chapter is on the Netherlands and Belgium, as you say, narco-state light. Why isn't there this longer period of sustained extreme violence, of this hybrid war? Why hasn't that happened yet, or why isn't that happening in the Netherlands and Belgium?
Well, but basically, cartels use violence only when necessary, criminal organization, because violence alerts authorities, and it basically drug trafficking organizations, they prefer a peaceful environment where they can conduct illegal transactions without being disturbed by the authorities. And committing acts of violence will alert authorities that they will intervene. So I basically think the Dutch crime syndicates, the Mokka Mafia, sometimes use extreme violence, but the Dutch crime syndicates, they somehow decided that peaceful cooperation, coexistence is the best for everybody. And you see that in some areas as well in Mexico, that some cartels basically decide, listen, the plaza or the area of operation is big enough for two cartels, and you can do your thing and we do our thing, and we don't bother each other, because violence is a huge waste of money and human resources. And so in Holland, I think also you don't have the very remote regions. It's much more controlled and environments, and it's this, especially the remote areas in Mexico become zones of anarchy. I mean the Sierra Madre, the big mountains where El Chapo was supposed to be hiding. It's a mountain range from 2,000 kilometers long. And nearly 300 or 400 kilometers wide, and there is only one road that goes from the west to the east, and it for the rest completely inaccessible. And there you have these groups exploring in complete autonomy.
Yeah, of course, the territorial element is a geographical element is essential.
A lot more competition between different crime groups in Mexico, and. I think the economical stakes are, I mean, in Holland, it's a pretty big business, but the economical stakes are not that high as in Mexico.
Well, it's been very interesting, and I think that the situation deserves lots of this kinds of study, because, well, you've very well shown in your book that the situation is very complex, but also that it can be grasped better with the use of theory and in that study.
I see this drug violence of organized drug trafficking as international monster, and it's present all over the world, but it manifests itself every region in different way depending on the climate. And I would compare it with some kind of fungus. If it's hot and sunny, it grows very fast and extreme. And if it's cold and dark, it grows slowly. And I mean, in Mexico, you have circumstances like extreme corruption already going on for hundreds of years, and extreme economic inequality. And that's also one of the reasons why this drug business and the drug violence explodes. And in Holland, yes, there's corruption too, but not at the scale as in Mexico, and there's economic inequality too, but again, not at the scale of Mexico, but I always say, listen, we need to watch out, because in our inner cities in Holland and Belgium and Paris, and actually they're not the inner cities, that's typical US, where the ghettos are inside the city, but they're more like the outer cities, the suburbs. You have like a huge class of disposable people and people with no income who just feel rage and frustration against the system. And these are the recruits for not only these not people that will use drugs to escape, but these are also the recruits, the foot soldiers for the criminal organizations.
No, I think that you're very pertinent there in saying that there are many social and economical vulnerabilities in some places, and especially in Mexico, the socio-economical vulnerabilities, then combined with the huge opportunities that drug trade provides.
The social extremes are much bigger in Mexico as in Holland, but the Holland tend to be a little bit smirky. Oh, this won't happen with us, but it won't happen at the same scale, but at a different intensity, but it's still the same phenomenon of international organized drug crime.
Yeah, I think you have a point that the combination of the vulnerabilities and the economic opportunities provide a sort of perfect storm in Mexico. One final question. So a couple of weeks ago, we tried to schedule a meeting, but you were on a trip to the US for your next project. Would you maybe care to share with us what it is exactly that you're working on now, what we can look forward to?
My next project is very exciting. And I think most of my projects are always exciting because I hate boring stuff. And I'm right now writing a book on global trends in crystal meth. And I describe the world of crystal meth from a historical point of view, from a chemical point of view, pharmaceutical point of view. But also I go to different zones where they consume and produce. And crystal meth is drug completely on the rise. Like 20 years ago, it was only used in some pockets in the US, but then it became, for all kind of reasons, it became export number one from Mexico to the US. And suddenly, the last 5 years, we have seen a complete emergence of crystal meth labs in the Netherlands and Belgium. I mean, 5 years ago, there was not one drug lab found, a crystal meth lab, and now suddenly all the ecstasy producing labs, because in Holland we have a huge industry that produce MDMA and ecstasy, the party pills. They are switching from ecstasy to crystal meth, and last year there were 32 labs discovered. So basically, I follow. I went to Mexico. I talked to drug producing cartels, to consumers, to addicts. I just came back from the US. I talk upstate Michigan, where crystal meth is consumed in the lower socioeconomic white underclass. But I went to Skid Row again, the Skid Row as well, the homeless community in central Los Angeles. And there suddenly you see that crystal meth has taken over from crack as the favorite drug of choice for all homeless people, but worldwide. And it's enormous potential. All this class of expendable, disposable homeless people, illegal immigrants, and they all turn to crystal meth, and it's a huge nightmare. And they right now even make it in Afghanistan from a local plant, and then they export it to Pakistan, and it winds up in the streets of Zimbabwe and Cape Town. So it has become a completely global project. I mean, the crystal meth produced in the Netherlands is mostly exported to Australia, because we have here a very small niche market, and mostly people from the gay scene that use it for sex parties as stimulants. But it's extremely interesting story also because crystal meth was completely legal in the Second World War, where it was used by the German army and given to its soldiers. So it's a very fascinating drug, extremely dangerous, the most addictive. It's actually a fascinating story. And so I did my Mexico research and my US research, and later on this year I hope to go to Afghanistan and also the Golden Triangle, because the Golden Triangle, the border area, Laos, Thailand and Burma or Myanmar, used to be all about heroin and opium, and now they switched to crystal meth as well. So it's a very dynamic situation, and I meet amazing characters, I must say. And as an anthropologist and as a photographer, it's a very great, challenging job. And I have a book contract, will become a book in Holland. And I'm right now looking for a US or UK publisher.
Fascinating. I'm really looking forward to that. Thanks for sharing, Tone.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, I guess that was it for today. Thanks so much once again for the whole talk. And I guess we'll talk soon as your next book is coming out.
Yeah, and thanks so much for your interest. And hopefully we can talk next year about my new book. Yeah.